everybody. What's going on? Welcome to CommanderCast. This is the weekly EDH/Commander podcast about community, strategy, and technology, available every week on mtgcast.com, quietspeculation.com, and, of course, our glorious home site, CommanderCast World Headquarters at CommanderCast.com. My name is Andy, a.k.a. Ghosts. I am the podcast producer and director locally. I am a league organizer, and I am a casual Magic scrub who's mostly here because I handle the technical side of things on the podcast. But joining me, I have two players who I am just assuming are empirically better at Magic than I am, and then one who most likely is, but I don't have as much experience with, but he's certainly better at building decks. So we'll go over the OGs first. Byron and Carlos are with me. If you guys can introduce yourselves, please.
All right. My name is Byron. I go by Surging Chaos online everywhere. I have been doing CommanderCast with Andy since the very beginning. I'm a fairly competitive player. I like to build good decks. I like playing monocolored. I've been playing some multicolored and stuff, and I'm basically just your typical Commander player, to be honest.
All right, and I'm Carlos. I go by CAG5383 on the internet. I write a weekly column for Quiet Speculation on Commander deck building, and Mr. Scotty Mack from over on the A-Team says that I'm the resident mad genius when it comes to deck building. I has to have Gatherer open when he's looking at my stuff, so anything that's a little bit off the wall, a little bit, you know, out there, that's more what I'm interested in.
He's the Laboratory Maniac, or whatever that stupid card from Innistrad is.
Yeah, it is Laboratory Maniac.
Yeah, they're just going to, we're going to Photoshop Carlos's head on that bitch, and we'll be good to go. And then this week as our guest, we have Calvin, a.k.a. Captain Red Zone, who is like a super longtime CommanderCast listener. Like probably, I think, since the first episode. He was, one of our first people to send us an email. So we've never had him on the show, which is like very surprising. But now he's running an excellent blog. So Calvin, introduce yourself and the site, please.
Well, this is Calvin. I'm also go by Captain Red Zone, the podcast listener formerly known as Ravenous. If you've listened to CommanderCast before, you might have heard me on the first call-in show in Season 1. Something else you may have known me for is from one of the first original decks that CommanderCast went over was the Guapazi Blue-White Control deck, which is something that I had submitted.
Oh, yeah! I remember that. Man, that feels like it was so long ago.
Yeah.
It's because it was a very long time ago.
I guess it was. Yeah, almost a year, actually.
Almost a year.
Actually, you know what? The day that this airs, the day after, it will have been 1 year of CommanderCast.
See?
Mind-blowing.
I've been listening ever since episode one.
And then Calvin also runs Three to the Face.
Three to the Face is my blog spot that I have on. It's threetoface.blogspot.com. Basically, my little site is pretty much designed for theme-based and mechanic-based EDH decks or commander decks, however you want to contact it. Mostly everything I do is pretty much just something that I come up with out of my own particular thing and try to stay away from power cards and stuff like that.
So if you're looking for something a little bit different, yeah, it's something that we always go over on the knowledge pool before it's posted and everything. And these decks are pretty sweet, and there's always usually get one or two pretty good Photoshops of cards in there as well, which I always enjoy.
Oh, yeah, like the Guapai Z to look like Ted DiBiase.
Yeah, or the Crystal Ball, optionally.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that'll hold you down. So in terms of podcast news, November is crossover month at CommanderCast, so prepare yourself for that. Crossover Month is an initiative that I was working on. I guess it probably started in September. And the idea is that every single piece of content that is on CommanderCast will either feature people from other websites or will be produced by people from other websites. So our podcast every week will feature one podcast guest from another show on MTGCast and then a non-podcasting guest. Some of them from YouTube. We've got Geomancer from the EDH Rules Committee coming on to discuss some things with us. And then our articles and other content are entirely being ported from other websites, and our stuff, in exchange, is being ported to their home sites. So you'll see a lot of stuff from guys like on the Muse Vessel. Calvin, of course, is going to be involved. You know all those guys that were linked on the Friday Flashback. They're going to be showing up on CommanderCast, and in exchange, our stuff will be on their sites. And an additional thing is that we're going to have the Canadian All-Stars of EDH on CommanderCast with one of our episodes for Crossover Month, where we're going to be having Scotty Mack and Jay Boosh from the A-Team, as well as my man Durfington from Dirtling Around on. So that should be a pretty solid episode. But that's it for podcast news this week. Next, we're going to take it into our community segment. This is our Halloween-themed episode. This is going to be a very weak theme, so don't jump down my throat about that. I'm not going to be making too many Vincent Price-esque sounds. Maybe I should incorporate some in post-production.
Starring Vincent Price, truly a master of the macabre.
But anyway, our next thing is going to be Haunting Your Tormentors, where we're talking about a topic suggested by Alex, a.k.a. Walking to Work, on Twitter.
I'm going to torture you, Isabella. I'm going to make you suffer for your faithlessness to me. You harlot!
Alright, so in this week's community segment, the first thing we're talking about is Haunting Your Tormentor.
Oh god, I'm getting so fucking scared already.
So what we mean by that is, if someone stabs you in the back during a game, is it acceptable to go and metagame your deck or build a new deck that is designed specifically to beat up on theirs and make sure that they don't do anything and you wreck their face the next game? And, I don't know, like, there's a thin line between metagaming and just trying to be obnoxious. And there's a difference, like, metagaming means that you have a difficult time and you need a couple extra cards to make sure that someone doesn't get out of hand, where just being obnoxious means it's just out of spite. There's no reason for it. And I don't know. I don't think it's really necessary. I feel like there are better ways to solve that kind of problem.
I think once you cross that border from including a couple of cards in your deck that maybe either are silver bullets or overall improve your strength into constructing an entire deck specifically designed to combat one strategy, you've gone from regular guy to neckbeard territory. And that's a bad territory to be in. Like, that's the scariest territory to be in, actually.
That's Kyle Orton territory.
I don't understand the reference, but I'm going to run with it. Totally like this Kyle guy.
To all our NFL fans out there, you'll get the reference.
If you have designed an entire deck specifically to, like, spite a person, like, just look at the effort that you've put in to get so little satisfaction. Like, that's what you really need to look at. How valuable is your time? If you value it that lowly, then we have baseline self-esteem issues that we need to go over before we talk about Commander, and then let's talk about metagame stuff. But if you're going to sit there and construct a deck, like 100 cards from top to bottom, to deal with one guy that's been screwing you in a game, or even a deck that you have a really difficult time with, it's just not a good way to go about things for a game that's intended to be socially played.
Well, looking at it from a deck builder's perspective, one of the big problems that immediately arises when you try to focus on taking out, like, one person, just building your deck around getting rid of that one person, is that you're really limiting your deck to what it can do, because you're so focused on interacting on one axis instead of all the other axes of interactivity that other players at the table might be playing with. So, like, for example, let's say someone's playing Karn and he's been giving you problems because he's been, like, dropping artifacts left and right all game and doing all sorts of shenanigans. So then you load up your deck with just, like, literally nothing but artifact destruction. Well, it's nice when you can kill Karn, but it's really going to suck when you have to deal with other players at the table that don't run as many artifacts, and all of a sudden you're left holding the bag with all these artifact destruction spells that really don't do much. So when I look at it from a deck building perspective, it's very detrimental just to your deck as a whole, especially in a format where you play with singletons. You only have 99 cards plus your general, and the 99 cards goes by really fast, especially when you're trying to squeeze answers in your deck to begin with. It hurts you as a deck builder, because when you're trying to play against the whole table, it's really difficult to do that when you only have, like, really one way to interact with one person.
One of the ways I actually kind of don't really understand why you would actually want to do something like this extensive against a particular individual is because most of the people in my particular area, we all have multiple decks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the, so player A, for some reason, decides he wants to run deck that graveyard hates everybody out the game with some type of lock on the board. And yeah, okay, fine. I understand you might want to put some cards into your deck to prevent being hated out against or potentially having decks X or Y randomly destroy your deck. But in the same token, the next week when you play with that player, he may not even be using the same deck. And now you have, like, 10 to 15 cards in your deck or potentially that you put in just so you could take care of this one particular general that was annoying the crap out of you last week. And suddenly he's not even – that deck doesn't even exist anymore. He took it apart. He didn't even like it.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of that fine line, like Carlos was talking about, between the metagame and, the deck construction, because, you know – a couple of cards here and there, like that is an important thing that I think we're trying to paint a line here. building a deck is one thing. Modifying your deck is, in fact, just intelligent. There is an extent to which I think it's prudent to metagame and include cards. Another thing is getting repeatedly destroyed by someone with their particular deck. That's usually a good learning experience, because if you realize, okay, I need to put a couple of cards in my deck, then, yeah, you're just becoming a better player, you're expanding your knowledge of the card pool, and you're expanding the ways that your deck can interact with other decks. But, you know, once you cross over that line between, oh, I hate this deck, I need a couple answers to it, to I've saturated my deck, 1 minute you're fine, the next minute you're going fucking sideways over a cliff, and you're playing against someone with a deck that's full of dead draws, and that is the last thing that anybody wants to experience. Because even if you ruin the guy that's playing the strategy you don't like, it's not going to be fun for him, and then once you've dealt with him, it's certainly not going to be fun for you to be totally ineffective.
I think there's two other things that we can sort of talk about here. The first is that if you lose to a deck once or twice, you shouldn't immediately start like trying to find cards that you can add to get an advantage. You can also think about how you're approaching it and how you can change the way that you play to get a better advantage. Like, should you be holding Swords to Plowshares and Path to Exile for creatures that need to be exiled instead of just creatures you don't want on the table? There are small ways that you can change the way you're playing to deal with some things instead of building a whole new deck or adding like 10 new cards to help deal with it. The other is that there are some decks that are going to necessitate reconstructing your whole deck to try to deal with, like the stupid Hermit Druid combo decks or the Azami combo decks or whatever. If you want to interact with them meaningfully without getting like exactly the cards that you need, you're going to have to add more of the kind of effects that they care about.
Also, going off a completely different tangent, sometimes like if you lose to a deck and it happens like once or twice, sometimes it can just be random at times. I mean, Commander is one of those formats where you're playing with singletons, it's going to be random by nature. Even with people like wanting to run tutors and card draw to try to increase the consistencies of their deck, I mean, the format is still very random as a whole. So you don't want to. So if you're getting tripped up like once or twice by a deck that's not really rubbing you the right way, don't automatically assume that you should go into full bore hate mode and try to just, you know, obliterate that person in the next Stone Age or something, or just try to hate them out every single game forever and ever. I'm just trying to say, like, sometimes you're going to get randomed out. I mean, it happens to all of us. You're going to get randomed out by an infinite combo here and there. You're going to get randomed out by a token army. You're going to get randomed out by graveyard recursion. I mean, it's just going to happen. If it becomes a pattern, that's when you should probably start, like, making actual changes to your deck.
One of my things I was going to say is that if you have a particular game state where somebody's actually backstabbing you. It's like you set up a pat where something's occurring and you're currently continuously losing because you were expecting him to do something for you and he's not, then that's your fault. You should realize that this guy is not helping. This guy is potentially ruining your game. And every time he makes a deal with you, he's probably just going to lie to you and just backstab you anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently your resources are being spent in the wrong direction because you're probably using them to reserve against somebody else, when you could be using it to take care of him. You wouldn't even need to change your deck around at that point. It just becomes more of the, oh, well, I see you have a board, I have a raft, I'm clearing it.
Now, I think this is a very different discussion once you kind of move into the realm of the one-on-one environment, because I think it's a little bit better sculpted, and there's a couple of decks that are more commonly accepted as being serious decks. So if for those of you that have some experience with the kind of one-on-one environments, whether they are local or online or however you guys roll on that, what's your kind of experience in terms of building decks? How specifically do you have to engineer your hate to deal with that single opponent? Because in one-on-one games, it's a far more viable strategy. That's just a general principle of Magic.
But one of the things that I personally discovered about doing games one-on-one, because a lot of my personal like decks in the real are designed to be played either one-on-one or multiple, because a lot of times my testing comes from me just basically being around with like one or two friends and just playing with them.
So to answer your question, Andy, about like how answers change in like 1v1 games, when 1v1 starts to become like more and more competitive in your area, what tends to happen is that the mana curves of your decks drops drastically. Like a lot of like competitive 1v1 decks, like in France, because France is really big on 1v1 commander, most of the mana curves in those decks, they end at 4. Like, they don't even run, like, a lot of 5 or 6 cast stuff that you commonly see, like, in multiplayer commander decks, because those spells are just too bulky for the format. I mean, the critical turns are turns, like, 1, 2, and 3, basically. So, like, if you're looking for a kind of answer that, you want to metagame against for a certain deck, like in 1v1, usually low curve answers are your best bet because you need to get that answer out quickly. That's been the case, like, in my experience in 1v1 because it's very close to, like, an actual Eternal format to where, like, mana curves actually matter.
Okay, now to kind of shift the topic in another direction. When this topic was suggested, it was largely about, you know, building decks specifically to ruin somebody's fun. But what are some personal examples that you guys have of a game where maybe you have had your fun ruined or your game plan just utterly destroyed by a deck, be it the deck's overall archetype or a couple of cards, and you think there's kind of been a learning experience for you or a positive impact when you went home and you thought, oh man, I got to change this and that about my deck? Because the best example that I have was I had an old Intet deck. It was one of my first decks. And God bless those guys out in Belleville, but the first time one of them cast Ruination, my life changed forever. Like, Ruination suddenly started to appear in a lot of places, and basic lands became a priority yet again. And not only has that saved me a significant amount of money, I think, but I genuinely think that it's improved the quality of my decks overall, because my environment, some people have said that it appears slightly warped because of the large quantity of non-basic hate, but I think that only makes sense because it's one of the few mechanisms that allow you to check the more powerful multicolored decks. So to me, that was a learning experience. I played against a guy, mono-red deck, don't even remember the general. All I remember, or sorry, it was blue-red, so it must have been the Tibor and Lumia deck. I remember a lot of back to basics and a lot of Blood Moon, and I remember a lot of losing. And you know what? That was an okay experience. I didn't build a deck to destroy him. I went home and I became a better deck builder. And I think that's the kind of experience you want from these, instead of, oh, this guy's a fucking dick. I'm going to go home and build something that's just going to ruin him every time we play.
For me, dealing with token swarms has usually been a problem for me, because they can rebuild really easily off of Wrath and most sweepers that get played in the format. And they're usually really good when they have, like, global pump spells like Overwhelming Stampede and Beastmaster Ascension. I've had my fair share of losing to generals like Hazian Tamar, however you pronounce it, or like Tolsmir Wolfblood, Riz the Redeemed, token-based decks. And one of the things that I've kind of learned over time, just losing to just tons of tokens like that, is to basically run not just more sweepers against those kind of decks, but stuff that actually answers tokens effectively so that their resiliency is not taken advantage of. So things like propaganda effects, mode effects, also like Knight of Souls Betrayal, I found has been a really powerful option, and more recently Elesh Norn. Token swarms have generally been like a go-to strategy for a lot of aggro decks because of that resiliency they provide and the explosiveness they get from the global pump effects. And the thing I took out of those overall experiences that I've had over many games is that Wraths alone aren't enough to like answer armies. Like, you need other things. Like, even propaganda effects and mode effects are amazing because they encourage your opponents to attack other people instead of you, for example.
All right, I've actually got one example of each of those. The first is I'm pretty well known for playing the multicolor control decks that Andy likes to stomp with Ruination and Back to Basics, and like just this weekend I lost a game to Graceful Antelope of all things.
Oh.
Is that the creature that turns all your lands into planes?
Yes.
Turns them all into planes very slowly, one at a time. Yes.
So the thing I've learned from losing to Blood Moon and Magus the Moon and Graceful Antelope one too many times is that sometimes Oblivion Stone is better than Pernicious Deed, and sometimes you need to run two basics instead of one basic, or you need to fetch them up more proactively. Like, you need to be a little bit more careful about which cards you're playing of certain kinds of effects, and you can play around things like that. I added Kasali Pride Mage and Maelstrom Pulse as efficient ways to deal with them, and I can fetch up the basics that can play them. And after that, it wasn't that big of a problem as long as I was careful. Sometimes you got locked out for a couple turns, and sometimes they just killed you, but usually you could find an answer. My other example was there was a play group I used to play with where everyone liked to play tribal. One guy had elves, one guy had goblins, there was soldiers and spirits and whatever, and someone decided to build the Engineered Plague, the deck, and Sabo's Decree, and all kinds of things like that, and so all they would
what
do is,
what a champion.
Oh, I've seen that.
Opalescence, start cloning my Engineered Plague. Like, no one's going to have any creatures. And, like, sure, it was kind of clever the first time, but then, like, no one gets to do anything, and we just sit there, like, waiting for someone to find a way to sweep away all these enchantments, and then they just replenish them back into play, and it's just miserable when something like that happens. And sure they won, but like, no one wants to play with you anymore.
At what cost are you winning?
One of the examples I have is going to probably end up coming from the other end of the table, because I've actually had people hate out against me. If you follow anything that I've done, one of my favorite decks that I currently have built, and it's probably the only deck that I currently have that I would even think about foiling out, is my Balthor the Defiled deck. It's basically a mono-black deck that runs on a mono-black dredge engine, and most of my turns don't last longer than my own personal upkeep.
Interesting.
Well, because there's a zombie creature that I have in there where I can cycle him at the during my upkeep to draw a card.
Oh, Under Gladiator.
Yeah, there we go. The Gladiator. And I cycle him out, dredge, get a dredge creature back, discard the dredge creature, bring him back into my hand, cycle again, and continue just milling my graveyard out, my deck into my graveyard until I tap out a mana. So basically, my main turns are upkeep, main phase skipped, battle phase skipped, end turn, go. And when I first started playing the deck, a lot of people in my area didn't really understand what I was doing. They just kind of just saw me just throwing cards away. And eventually, my brother caught on. And he kind of got tired of seeing zombie hordes randomly pick up every time I played his deck. So every time I started playing the deck, he started playing his Child of Alar deck. And what would end up happening is that every time I tried to use Balthor to bring my zombies back, one of my zombies would come back like the Fleshbag Marauder. He would get his Child of Alar out of the graveyard and then just use it to sacrifice it and just kill all my creatures again. I mean, on the upside, it's like the board basically stayed empty, but on the other end, it's like until I could actually figure out how to get rid of this stupid child, there was nothing I could do for most of the times I played him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't imagine that was particularly fun for either of you, just kind of sitting there at a stalemate for a very long time until you either drew like specific answer cards, like very specific corner case answer cards, or somebody concedes. Probably not the greatest way to play the game.
Usually at a certain point, I just kind of just stopped bringing out the Balthor because I was like, you know what, I don't feel like doing this. I'm going to wait until someone like gets rid of one of our graveyards. Then we can figure out where this game is going. And usually one of the other players would drop like a Bajuko Bog and remove my stuff. And I was like, oh, well, looks like I'm out.
Yeah. All right. So that's it for our discussion on Haunting Your Tormentors. To kind of recap, it started off with a rather humorous tweet that I got from Alex, a.k.a. Walknwork on Twitter. He was talking about how you can build a deck, whether it's okay to build a deck to just blow someone out that backstabs you in the game. But I think we went over the kind of more serious context beneath it, not saying he was implying that or anything. We just read really far into it. So we were talking about building decks to specifically defeat other decks in your metagame that are giving you problems, where you're kind of drawing the line between including a couple cards to metagame and building decks specifically to ruin people, and why it's not necessarily a great idea. But next we're going to move into charity cases, as usual, and I'm going to be talking about the wonderful things that people have contributed to Gifts Given for this week for the Child's Play charity. This is Charity Cases. This is the weekly segment on CommanderCast where I run down the contributions that people have made this week to the Gifts Given charity drive with their pledges. If you need more information on the charity drive itself or its purposes, head over to CommanderCast.com, and there's a link on the right-hand side of the page where you can look into how to make donations, what kind of stuff we're looking for, and as well there's a list of the current donations that we've received as well in pledges, things that will be auctioned ultimately on eBay in December to raise money for Child's Play. So to get right into it, if you're not sure what the purpose of this is, actually, there's an interesting shout-out that I received from Scott, a.k.a. Scott Holmes. It's pretty long, so I'm not going to read it all to you in case you're not interested in the way that this whole thing is going. But if you have any interest, I recommend you go over to CommanderCast.com and check the show notes for this one. I'm going to have that copy-pasted there in its entirety. And he pretty much describes the reason that we're doing this better than I ever could have. So go over there, check that out if you're curious about what Gifts Given is all about. And with that, we're going to get right into what people have contributed this week. So Brian T., he lives in Holland, Pennsylvania. And his contribution is actually going to be running a charity tournament, and he's going to contribute the entry fees to Gifts Given and on behalf of everyone in the New Holland, Pennsylvania EDH community. So I'd like to thank you for that, Brian T. And I would like to say that this is probably a really solid way to raise funds if that's something that you're looking to do and you're not sure what you want to contribute, or you don't want to just send a lot of money in, or if you just want to kind of do something with your community for the purposes of this charity. I've been to a couple of these charity tournaments in the past, not only for Magic, but for other games as well. And they're generally pretty successful, even in very small communities. So if you're looking for a way to help out, you know, don't discount this possibility. As well, this week we had Tim C. He sent in a lot of cards. He's got a signed Rexiel, so that's pretty awesome. As well, there's a couple foils in there. an Ink Moth Nexus, all kinds of good stuff, EDH playables. So thank you, Tim. Appreciate the contribution. Then Sean McEwen, you know him and his crazy last name. Anyway, Sean McEwen has an awesome contribution for us this week. He sent in one Zhao Dun the One-Eyed from Portal 3 Kingdoms, one of the like rarest, most difficult to find kind of commanders that are out there. And that was pretty awesome. He also shared us out on StarCityGames.com. I'm sure you'll hear from him again on the podcast in the near future. But yeah, Zhao Dun the One-Eyed is now going to be in one of the auction lots, so be sure to look for that because I know it's highly sought after. So thanks for the contribution, Sean. I really appreciate it. As well, we had Joseph. He's a local guy from the University of Toronto Magic Club. He actually invited me to play there once. I would like to make it out there more often, but Fridays just aren't really a good day for me. And he's got a great lot of EDH cards and some foils. There's quite a bit of cards in there. But then, like, kind of the icing on the cake, he has four really awesome alters. Now, I've seen Joseph's alters in the real, and they're pretty slick shit. Like, these are on point. So he's got a Mana Vault, an Eternal Witness, a Mystical Tutor, and a Worldly Tutor. So those are four eminently playable cards for Commander in many decks. And if you want some pimp alters of them, Joseph's got your back here. So those will be available in the final auction. I'd like to thank you for that, Joseph, and keep doing these alters because they're awesome. And then last this week, we have Devin. Devin contributed a lot of EDH playables, similarly to the other people this week. It's got a Sanguine Bond in there. It's got a Glissa in there, all kinds of stuff. Now, one thing, Devin mentioned that, you know, he's got a limited cards pool and he doesn't have a whole lot to contribute. I get that a lot from people that are sending in contributions here. Do not worry about that, guys. Anything counts. It's for charity, and it's not like I'm going to turn anything away. So if you're interested at all in contributing, just send in whatever you have. Let me know what it is. I do warn everyone that if I'm not able to sell cards, I have no plan to get rid of them right now, but I'm thinking pretty positively, and I'm sure most things will sell reasonably well. So yeah, if you have anything you want to send in, if you want to contribute in any way, go ahead and do that. And there's obviously outside the box ways to do that as well. Like Brian is demonstrating, he's been running the charity tournament. And then we have Jordan as well, who's running the Pack to Charity binder thing. And he's got a blog on that. Actually, I'll have a link in the show notes to it, where he's going to be tracing every step that he makes, all the trades that he makes, and all the cards that he receives, that kind of thing. So that's going to be an interesting project to continue to track. I believe I mentioned that last week on the podcast. So obviously there's more than just sending in moxes and stuff that you can do to contribute to this. And if you think of any other ways, be sure to let me know in an email so I can put it on this segment next week and I can tell other people about it. Because, hey, maybe somebody else is interested in doing something like running a charity tournament or starting up their own pack to binder, something along those lines. So if you have anything that you want to do, any way you can want to contribute, be sure to let me know. Get a hold of me. Cards aren't the only way. Some people have been contributing money directly via PayPal, that kind of thing. There are mechanisms in place for that, so let me know about that. But that's it for charity cases this week. Next, we're going to take it into the collector's worst nightmare, where we're going to be talking about reprints, ones that we're likely to see and ones we probably never will.
Okay, it's time for us to enter into the collector's worst nightmare. This is basically a section where we're going to be discussing things about reprints. Just to let you know, early on, this is not a technology section. We're basically just going to run through a few lists of cards that we've all gathered up together. And we're going to try to see which ones we could see would potentially be good to take off the reserves list to use as reprints, you know, personal wish lists and things like that. So to kick things off with my personal reserved list of things that I think would be great to see, which I know I will never see, is going to be cards like All Hallows Eve. Primarily, it's a card that's currently on a reserve list. It's a card that I personally think would have been great in one of the more recent sets that just kind of came out in like the last month or so. Hint, hint. But the problem here is that, all right, I'm about to go on a quick little tangent about the reserve list. There's roughly, 500 cards on there? And out of that 500 cards, roughly 50, 75 of them actually hold like value over than 25 cents. But these other 425 cards cannot be used or reprinted just because they just happen to be unlucky enough to show up in a set that happened to have Ancestry or Recall in it. And when you have a set that's basically coming out and it's pretty much horror themed, like Innistrad, and you have cards similar to like All Hallows Eve and things like that, you can't really use them to reprint because of the fact that they're from that set. And I personally think that the reserve list, I can understand why it would be used for collector's volume, but to an extent, it just kind of diminishes certain things that could potentially actually have value for other players in the game. But that's enough of my little personal rant.
Well, I think that that's a good topic to actually kind of discuss at this point, though, because maybe someday we'll do with something on the reserve list as a whole. But I think you touched on some valid points there. Like, for collectors, yeah, they would be a horrible thing to have this abolished. But for players, especially of a format like Commander, to me personally, I think the reserve list is the worst thing that's happened to Commander that had nothing to do with the player base doing it to themselves. Because like you've said, there are so many interesting cards, and there are so many empirically good cards as well. But even just if we're looking at interesting oddities, like you're talking about All Hallows Eve, that we just people don't have access to, even if they want to play them. And even if they want to access them, they're so expensive. They're forced to choose between, you know, getting a bunch of recent, newer, and maybe more powerful but less interesting cards, and getting something that's cool and interesting from an old set. And it just kind of sucks to force that decision on players. I would much rather see no issue there and just reprint some of these old cards. But I think Wizards has firmed up the reserve list recently, so it seems like they think it's something that's there to stay. And that's, you know, for reasons that I don't agree with, but whatever. Obviously, I'm not making the decisions up there.
Well, there are some cards on the reserve list, Andy, that just cannot be duplicated at all compared to cards that have been recently printed. Like, one of the cards I'd like to see reprinted that's on the reserve list is Invoke Prejudice. And basically what Invoke Prejudice does, it costs quadruple blue, and it's an enchantment that basically forces opponents to double the converted mana cost of their creatures' spells that they cast or they get countered. I mean, there's no other card in the game that does that effect. I mean, it's totally unique to that card. And it's a shame that cards like that can't be reprinted, because they have these really cool effects that can be run. Like, this card pretty much can only be run in mono blue decks because of that 4 blue mana cost. Just stuff like that being unable to be reprinted, I mean, it sucks. I mean, another example would be, like, In the Eye of Chaos. It's kind of the same thing. I mean, there's no other card in Magic that does something like In the Eye of Chaos does. And I agree with both of you. I mean, the reserve list is, it just sucks. I am firmly of the opinion that Magic is not an investment. I mean, it should not be, like, I don't want to rant too much here, but it's gotten to the point, Magic has gotten to the point to where we value cards as like stocks. We're like buying and selling stocks, essentially. And I mean, like, that's, I quoted someone on one of the forums that said Magic is not an investment. Why does everyone keep talking like they're buying stocks? I mean, Forbes 500 even had an article about one of the silliest things like people do to like make money, and one of them was invest in Magic cards. I mean, that
really
right there, yes. Where I'm coming from is I want to see cards like Invoke Prejudice and In the Eye of Chaos be reprinted, cards that have extremely unique abilities that pretty much no other card in Magic has. So that's where I'm coming from.
I have to agree, and that's really sort of the same place that I'm coming from when I look at the reserve list. Like, as someone who has sets of Duel Lands and Diamond Valleys and Tabernacles and whatever, like, it's nice that all these things are really expensive and that I could sell them for and not have to sell a kidney for something if I wanted to. But, like, I don't know, I'd rather be playing against people who also have these things instead of, like, them having to invest, like, their college savings or whatever to get some of these cards. Like, it's kind of ridiculous when you think about it that they could just reprint anything after the reserve list and you can't do anything about it. But just because they were printed before this time, that you have to respect their value. That just seems kind of
arbitrary,
ridiculous to me. Yeah. And so, like, some cards that I'd really love to see reprinted, the top of my list, not close, is Diamond Valley, because the card is insane. Once you have one and you've played with it, you never want to go without playing a Diamond Valley ever again.
And anyone
but
can
use it,
too.
But the card is just prohibitively expensive. Like, there's no reason to own it. It's not $100. Like, they're somewhere around, they're between $90 and $100 pretty regularly. There's no reason for anyone to spend $100 to have access to that kind of effect. It is very, very, very good, but it's not that good. And there's no reason, like, it doesn't get played in any format except Commander sometimes. Other than that, it's just sitting in binders. And because no one has access to them, they're still $100. And that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, even outside the realm of, like, really cutthroat cards, like, or generally very powerful cards, like what you're talking about there, Carlos, with the Diamond Valley, or Byron with the Invoke Prejudice, I think Calvin's example is such a good one of, like, a fun card that is worth money just because it's old and there's not that many out there. But people would play with them. Like, Commander is a format of theme decks. I think more than maybe any other format, you see the most deployed in Commander tables around the world. And it's kind of shitty that people can't take their themes to the nines, even if they're the appropriate cards that are available and they can't use them. It's just a shame. And it's also, I feel, creates this division within your playgroups when you kind of have haves and have-nots. Like, I have the good fortune to have a very broad and diverse group of playgroups, actually, and some have very young players in them that are very new to the game, and their card base might only stretch back as far as Rise of the Eldrazi or Shards of Alara. And it's not a pleasant feeling to be playing with these cards that you know they don't have and maybe can't access for, like, actual, you know, real-life financial reasons, and it gives you this advantage. It just, it feels kind of weird to me. So it's something I've always stayed away from, but having a reprint of some of these cards would give everyone kind of a fair shot at this, you know? And you'd also get to see these fun cards, too.
As far as, like, particular cards that they have, like, certain cards, I fully understand why they went and reprint certain ones from these particular sets, like Frankenstein's Monster, for example, because it has the whole, like, plus two counter.
It's just so awkward.
The counter body thing that it has where it pumps up with plus one counters, plus two, plus O, plus O, plus two. I can understand why you wouldn't reprint that, because it might make the game too technical for some people, might make it difficult to track. Things like that I can fully understand. But still, they've even gotten to the point where they said they're not even going to do, like, say, functional reprints of certain cards just because they can't, because it's on a reserve list. So you're telling me that you couldn't even do, like, a suspend version of All Hallows Eve and just take the Scream counters off and replace them with, like, Haunt counters or something, because it would be too close to the original, just because of this reserve list. In my view, I understand that, you know, Magic is a pretty big game. We have plenty of different cards, thousands upon thousands of different abilities, and all of them are different. And some of them are actually kind of similar and close. But by using the reserve list, there's certain levels of creativity that are automatically cut off because you can't make a copy of a particular card that's on this list. I understand from a business standpoint where they're trying to become a business where they say they're going to do something, they want to hold true to it for their collectors. But in the same token, it's like, when is your reserve list so important and your piece of cardboard is so important that I can't happen to get, like, another version of it just because you happen to make this when the game wasn't expected to be popular?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I want to move on then from the reserve list. We talked about some cards we'd like to see reprinted, but mostly we just talked about the reserve list, which is something I have no doubt we'll go into further depth in the future. But let's move on to the second part of the segment here. Maybe something that doesn't scare the collectors as much, not quite as scary, but what reprints would you guys like to see of things that could potentially happen someday? Like, for real skis that aren't on the reserve list? Because I figure things like lands are obvious, right? Like, we all want more shock lands in circulation and so on.
Fetch but, lands and, yeah.
Yeah, all that stuff, it'd be great to see. But there's, like, Doubling Season, which is a very expensive, by casual standards, casual card. And they can't reprint it because of, I'm assuming, the interaction with Planeswalkers that it has. And for that, I blame Planeswalkers, as always. Fuck Planeswalkers, but I think that they kind of missed the opportunity to reprint that in the box set, the Commander box set. Maybe they're just leaving room for the next one. But then there's also Force of Will and Mind's Eye. Those are going up in price. Solemn Simulacrum is still like $10, even though it was just reprinted. I don't know what we have to do to get the price down on that. But what are some other cards you guys would like to see that could potentially actually be cleared by Wizards someday for a reprint? What do you guys think would be awesome for Commander specifically? Don't worry about how it would interact with other formats.
Well, one thing I want to add in real quick is that even I can understand why they might not reprint, say, Doubling Season in, like, an actual set itself, like a core set or, like, a main set, like, for the fall season or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But that does not stop them from putting into, like, one of the Planeswalker versus Planeswalker sets. You could still reprint that particular card. We could get access to multiple copies of it, and it would not mess up any of their other formats. As far as cards that I personally would like to see reprinted, you know, one of the main things I actually think would be interesting would be Doubling Season. I really want a copy of that, but I don't want to have to spend like $20 just to get one.
And they're also just actually physically hard to find. Like, they're selling at $20. You know, like, and I can't remember the last time I actually saw one in a card shop, even if I was actually looking for one to pay for $20 for it.
You brought up Solemn Simulacrum about how high of a price he is. Solemn Simulacrum is one of those cards that is basically a universal staple. Like, pretty much every single deck runs him. And that's one of the things I'd like to see, is, like, more universal staples get reprinted. Like, one card that immediately comes to mind is Sensei's Divine Top. I don't know if you guys have seen the price on Sensei's Divine Top, but that card is approaching $20.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, the card is approaching $20. I mean, it's going to be a matter of time before it hits $25. I mean, as supply continues to dry up, I mean, the card is going to see a lot more play in Legacy now that Metal Misstep got banned.
Still have my Crystal Ball, so.
Yeah, so, I mean, cards like Crystal Ball exist as well to give you, like, substitutes for Sensei's Divine Top, but that card is very hard to replace. I mean, it's almost as universal as Sol Ring in a lot of instances, and Strip Mine. So, like, Sensei's Mine Top is a card I'd like to see reprinted. Psalm Simulacrum, that's probably going to have to see, like, either another print run, or it's going to have to become less popular in Standard before its price goes down. Because not even a reprinting in the Commander deck box decks dented the price on Psalm Simulacrum when it exploded, and it got reprinted in M12. Oh, yeah, I also want to add Gilded Lotus. Gilded Lotus is also one of those cards that is starting to get a little out of hand.
Yeah, that would be nice to see that one reprinted.
And Vesuva as well, while I'm also on that tangent.
Vesuva's a really good one. I don't know why that card's price hasn't dropped again. It exploded when Modern became a thing, and I made, like, $200 off of it, which was awesome. But the price never went back down that much, and I really don't understand why. Like, I don't know what they're at exactly right now, but...
They're, like, 10 bones.
You could get them for, like...
12.
You could get them for, like, 5 before that.
Yeah.
And they jumped up to 20... And now they're sitting at, like, between 10 and 15. And that seems kind of ridiculous when they don't see play in any format except Commander.
Actually, it was, like, slowly approaching $10 before it exploded to, like, 30. Because there was stress from the Commander market because Vesuva was starting to see more and more play. So it wasn't like a $4 or $5 junk rare and then it just, like, sextupled in price overnight. I mean, it had been seeing some gradual... increase in price. So that is definitely a sign that the Commander market can definitely take a toll on the prices on the secondary market.
You know what I want to see is a mass reprint of Snowlands.
Yes.
Like, just put out boxes of snow fucking basics. Snowlands. Literally. Here's a box.
I would be down with that, too.
100 of each type of Snowland. Go wild. It's $10.
That would be awesome.
Oh, yeah. And it's got new artwork, too.
No. Keep the Ice Age frame and the art. And okay. I am golden. Because there's so many cool cold snap cards, right? But they require snow. And snow lands are harder to find than the snow using cards.
Yep.
Like, it's crazy talk.
Yeah, you don't even want to get started on finding foils of them.
Oh, I know.
Oh, my God.
Started on foils of anything. It's so shitty. And I understand that most people don't care. Like, you guys know me. I don't care about proxies, so one way or another. But for people that don't like to use proxies, like... this is a thing that's really easy to remedy and would open up some interesting deck space for a lot of players. Many people use snow-covered lands just for the boring purpose of getting a one-sided extra planar lens or whatever. But a lot of people would actually probably use these cool snow cards, like that Haradar guy, whatever the hell his name is, the Rhymewind Master, that wizard that bounces things. People would probably use those cards, but the snow lands
snow-covered islands are like $3 a piece.
Yeah, like they're so hard to find. It's ridiculous. So let's just get a reprint of those, and I'm good. You know, like, that's actually the number one thing I would love to see a reprint of.
You heard it, Wizards. Andy wants Return to Cold Snap.
Let's get it! Cold Snap 2, the re-snappening bit. Get at me.
One of the cards I actually think would be pretty interesting to see get reprinted would probably be Umzawa Jitte.
Yeah, actually, good call.
It's a card, it's a legendary artifact. I understand that, and I understand what it did to Standard. Fully get that. No one wants to see it back in Standard because of how it was last time. But in the same token, it's still a pretty amazing card that could potentially just have a lot of extra uses outside of that. I mean, it's already legal and just in Modern, Legacy, and Vintage. And if they decide they want to use it in those formats, that's fine with me. But as far as Commander is concerned, it's the, okay, well, it only came out in one set, and granted, it did come out in that one pre-constructed box, but after that, you kind of have to fight just to get one now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's another card where the physical stocks of it are very low, and it's scarce. It's actually physically difficult to find.
Although, one thing that did help with Jitte is that it was a Grand Prix promo, which I would happen to know, considering I got an Umizawa Jitte when I went to Grand Prix Portland. Now, if we're talking about equipment, I think the one equipment that really needs to be reprinted desperately is Sword of Fire and Ice.
Or all the swords?
I was about to say that one.
Pretty much all the swords in general.
Can't we get, just a sweet Wu-Tang-themed From the Vault, and it's, like, From the Vault legendary weapons, like, with swords and all that shit, and it's got, like, all the swords, and Umizawa's Jitte, and the Dark Steel things in it? Like, come on, Wizards, are you listening to this? We're doing your work for you!
Yeah, it blows my mind that Sword of Fire and Ice and Sword of Light and Shadow especially are so expensive. Like, I remember Sword of Fire and Ice was like a $12 card for the longest of time, and Sword of Light and Shadow was like $7 for the longest of time. And then someone decided that they were undervalued, and then they just, like, exploded in price like fivefold. I mean, it's one of those. It's one of those cards that, like, again, I talked about this before when I was talking about, like, Invoke Prejudice. It's very hard to duplicate Sword of Fire and Ice and Sword of Light and Shadow because they're such unique pieces of equipment. I mean, there aren't exactly, like, substitutes for them. I mean, you have other swords, like Sword of Body and Mind, Sword of War and Peace, and Sword of Feast and Famine, but they don't have the same protections and abilities that, like, Sword of Fire and Ice and Sword of Light and Shadow provide. So I think the swords in general would be really nice reprints. And please, no Judge reprints, please, because Judge reprints do jack shit to actually increase the supply of a card. Like, Sword of Fire and Ice got a Judge reprint, and that didn't do anything.
Wasteland pretty.
Wasteland got a Judge reprint. It didn't do anything for its price. Dark Confidant got a Judge reprint. That didn't do anything either. Doubling Season got a Judge reprint. That did jack squat as well. I mean, no Judge reprints, period.
Bam. And while we're just, like, listing expensive cards that people like, let's get some Bribery, let's get Urborg, let's get Damnation, and let's see Genesis again. Why not, right? Although, actually, speaking of Genesis, I do think the Innistrad might be an interesting opportunity to reprint the Incarnations. Like, to me, they feel like they would fit in this set. It's a graveyard-themed set. It's already using mechanics from Odyssey. I think that if you just tweaked the art on them, they could kind of fit into the afterlife-slash-religious motif that they kind of have going on here. So why not? You know, just throwing that out there. Urborg would probably be kind of hard to justify, but yeah, whatever. We'll fit it in there. Oh, Phyrexians! You know, they did it in Mirrodin. Why not everywhere?
We could even throw Mutavault in. They have a tribal theme, right?
Yeah, hey, why not? You know, just, that's an expensive card people want. Why not? Those are big-time, like, commander staples that I think people would like to say. Now, are there any cards where you guys would kind of think, like, they're not necessarily power cards, but maybe there's cards that are just sort of actually, like, again, physically difficult to locate to play if you want to, instead of being more difficult to find just because of price. Because there are some sets that weren't open very much, like the aforementioned Cold Snap. Finding something like Attakar Valkyrie
immediately comes to mind, too.
Yeah, Future Sight as well. Because to me, yeah, the Attakar Valkyrie and the Rhymewind Dragon are cards that I've actively looked for more copies of, and I can't find them. Like, am I sensing maybe a snow-themed commander expansion? Come on, guys. Let's take it back to the frozen north.
Hey, Ken Noggle had tweeted those pictures about those snow-covered dual lands that could have been in the commander decks.
Wouldn't that have been the greatest day?
No, seriously, they were playtest cards. They had them in the decks, and they took them out for some reason.
Some reason, yes. I guess that's probably the closest thing to an explanation we'll ever get.
Mirari's Wake would be a good one. That's at $10.
Yeah. Good call. Yeah, well, Judgment, yeah, is another one of those cases where there just wasn't that much opened, right? I think they're trying, right? Like, yeah. Cabal Coffers was reprinted, Avatar of Woe has been reprinted multiple times. So it's not like, I don't want to give the impression, too, that we're just sitting here bagging on Wizards for, you know, trying to make it so that we can't play the game because it's too damn inaccessible. Like, the cards are too damn expensive. Like, that's not what we're saying, but for many people, this would be a nice boost, and I think that, as well, I would buy these products if they came out and they had these reprints in them. Like, why wouldn't people? You know, it would just, I think it would make business sense. But then again, I don't run a business, and I mostly talk out of my ass, so whatever. All right, so that's it for our segment on the Collector's Worst Nightmare, where we were talking about reprints, both the impact of the reserve list on Commander, what kind of cards we'd like to see from the reserve list, and then cards that are not on the reserve list that could feasibly be reprinted someday. So next we're going to take him to strategy, continuing with our weak Halloween theme. We're going to be talking about Taysa, Orzhov's Scion, because she has spirits and shit. So that's Halloween, right, guys?
Moving on to our strategy segment, and we're going to be doing a general profile. It's going to be Taysa, Orzhov's Scion, and we're going to be haunting people at this time with our ever-so-lovely goth chick, Taysa, Orzhov's Scion.
And that guy just creeping on her side.
I know.
Just straight creeping on
the
that
stalker. Checking her out. Okay, so in case you don't know what Taysa does, she is a 2-3... creature for one colorless, one white, and one black. She is a human advisor. Her first ability is sacrifice three white creatures, and then you exile target creature. And her second ability is whenever another black creature you control dies, you get to put a 1/1 white spirit creature token on the battlefield that has flying. So I feel I just want to kick things off with what exactly Taysa does, because that seems to be the most obvious place to start. Basically, what Taysa is, she is a token producer and part combo engine. And I say part combo engine because Taysa's first ability costs no mana at all. And sac effects that cost no mana to activate tend to be used for combo engines. And Taysa generally is not an exception. So, for the most part, Taysa creates tokens, picks off creatures, gives you some resiliency with the second ability as well. She's also like a great sac engine because you can turn like black creatures that keep coming back, like Bloodgust and Reassembling Skeleton, and you can just keep making a steady stream of tokens. You can also use like white token production to your advantage, like Sacred Mesa and White Sun Zenith, and exile like tons of creatures. And that's basically what Taysa does. She is mainly token production. She has some semblance of combo in her because of the fact, once again, that her first ability costs no mana to activate, and that tends to open up the door for combos. So those are the kind of archetypes that Taysa supports. Token production, sac engines, sacrifice outlets, some combo in her with some certain combo pieces. And those are the kind of archetypes that Taysa usually lumps into. And sometimes you might see like good stuff decks sometimes just because of the color combination Taysa supports.
Byron pretty much hit it on the head. There's like 2.5 directions you can take Taysa. You can do the you can do a combo. She is a combo machine. Darkest Hour is a rare from Urza's Saga. Costs a black. All your creatures are black. So suddenly, your guy dies, you get a black spirit. It dies, you get a black spirit. You can do all kinds of stupid things with that. Nimdeath Mantle and Ashnod's Altar or Phyrexian Altar, you get infinite mana and infinite comes into play abilities on whatever other creature you have. You can use Revelark and Karmic Guide. You can use Mirror Entity. You can do all kinds of stupid things where all the pieces are interchangeable and all the pieces are easily tutorable, and you can build a very Taysa-centric combo deck that just kind of brutally wrecks the table pretty efficiently, pretty easily, and by turn 5 or 6 almost every game. You can build a token deck that uses white token generators and just Taysa's removal to get your guys through, and you have some black card advantage engines that also generate tokens, and that's a direction that you can go. And similarly, you can build an attrition deck that uses the Grave Pact and Skull Clamp and attrition and Sadistic Hypnotist with guys like Bloodgust and Reassembling Skeleton, like Byron mentioned, and just grind out card advantage over a really long game. And those decks tend to look very similar to Ghost Council decks or the Vishkal decks that are just all the best white-black recursion spells that let you generate small advantages over a very long game.
Okay, so I guess my reason that, because I don't know anything about Taysa, I'm not going to pretend otherwise. I guess my primary question at this point then is, why would you bother putting Taysa at the helm of the deck as opposed to either of the other commanders that you can put into this color combination? Is it just because she provides you access to the combo or what?
Well, Taysa does two things that the others don't. The other two are also both free sac outlets, but Taysa generates more guys, so she's a combo engine, and she also, instead of just killing guys or instead of being a threat that's hard to remove that drains life, she exiles creatures, which is insane against a lot of other decks. Most decks are built on these value engines with Eternal Witness and Genesis and whatever, and being able to exile things instead of just giving them -1/-1 counters with Vishkal or whatever is very, very powerful.
I totally agree with you, Carlos, about the ability to exile creatures, because I cannot get enough of just how important that is to exile creatures instead of just destroying it, especially in my playgroup, because my playgroup abuses reanimation effects, abuses Sun Titan, abuses Volrath Stronghold. Being able to exile a creature instead of destroy it it makes all the difference in the world. And then also the fact that Taysa only costs 3 mana, and that's very cheap for a commander.
Mm-hmm.
Vishkal costs 7, which is a ton of mana for a white-black deck, because white-black generally doesn't have access to mana ramp, because you don't have green, and you can only run mana artifacts to really get up to that 7 mana. And Ghost Council Orzhava, Ghost Council is extremely color intensive, requiring double white and double black, and usually he costs 5 mana because you want to leave 1 mana open to be able to blink out your Ghost Council. So another edge that Taysa has over the black-white generals that hasn't been mentioned again is her really cheap cost. It's really effective.
Well, one of the cards I actually think work really great with Taysa, myself, is actually one of the other legendary creatures. That's called the Blood Arbiter. primarily because he has a way to sacrifice creatures, and he gets the plus X plus one counters on him, and X is equal to the, what is it, the power of the creature that he has sacrificed?
Yes, mm-hmm. It's the power.
But one of the things I find interesting about him is that you can actually use him, sacrifice black creatures, get white flying tokens, and then you could use the tokens from that creature to be able to give to Taysa to remove something without having to use his second ability to actually try to kill off a creature. One of the other cards that I think actually works pretty well with Taysa is Bitter Blossom. Because
yes.
Granted, you're going to be taking the life point burn by basically getting the 1-1 fairy. But when you chump block with the 1-1 black fairy and it dies, Taysa then gives you a 1-1 white spirit with flying. So it's almost like she just converts your fairies from whites, from blacks to whites.
It can be hard to attack through as well, because you have to go through two creatures.
Yeah.
I like the pairing of Vishkal with her especially, though, because like not only does removing the tokens, it provides you with the sack outlet that you want in the first place, she also just clears the way for him to hit super hard. So that seems pretty good in my eyes.
Yeah, like something that we're going to keep coming back to as we talked about this is that all the black-white legends are very good with each other. Taysa and Ghost Council were in multiple decks together while they were in standard. Most decks that are playing that are black-white, you can change the generals pretty interchangeably, if not completely, if they're like built around Taysa's ability to make multiple guys. But a lot of the interactions are going to be the same.
Okay, so we've kind of gone over what Taysa is all about, her whole Thug Thizzle, as it were, and we've gone over some of her strengths, like she's outstanding at removing creatures, and she's great at creating combos that you can pretty much convert that loop into whatever you want to ultimately win the game. Now, what are, like, your archetypes that you guys fare well against in particular? Like, are there any matchups that you guys think she's especially well-suited to if you're looking for kind of a metagame choice general? Or are there any archetypes in particular that she's also poor against, conversely? Because to me, it seems like she doesn't have that typical failing that a lot of black-white decks do, where she would fold up to the graveyard hate. She doesn't seem to rely on that as heavily as a lot of other decks do.
One of the archetypes that I think that she actually does really great against is Voltron Strategies, because you could easily get a bunch of tokens onto the field. With her only costing 3 mana, she hits the board early. So, say for instance, your opponent is playing, well, I was about to say you're out, but you can't target him. Damn hexproof. Mm-hmm. But say for instance your opponent is using like a particular general, like say Aisling the Pilgrim. Granted, Aisling comes down earlier, but Taysa could potentially be able to just continuously remove her. And without actually having any particular like hexproof or like Swiftwood Boots or Lightning Greaves to protect your general, if you're doing a Voltron strategy, she could very easily like put your general out of range just by using the token she has to keep removing him and removing him and removing him.
To go off what Calvin was saying, Taysa's very good against aggressive strategies in general. Like, you're in the color with the most, you're in the color combination with the most Wrath of Gods. You get infinite chump blockers. You can remove creatures from the game. Like, you have Ghost Council and all kinds of other ways to gain life. You can do a lot of really unfair things to creature decks. Like most recursion decks, depending on just how dependent you are on the graveyard, you can get wrecked by enough graveyard hate. What exactly enough is depends on just how dependent you are on it and how efficiently you can set up the engine and how much you overextend into graveyard hate. But generally, you can get shut down by 2 to 3 pieces. The other thing that Taysa decks tend to have a lot of trouble against are counterspell-based control decks, because there aren't that many cards that you have that matter. Your combo pieces matter, like Debtor's Knell or Necromancy or whatever matter, but besides that, they can just, like, you played a 2-3, and that doesn't do very much.
All right, so I find Taysa also does well against decks that rely a lot on short-term advantage. Andy brought up this term before in previous podcasts a while ago, called musket decks, where they're designed to unload their resources on like one or two people, and then it's spending the rest of the game trying to reload and take out the other rest of the table. And because of Taysa's ability to keep generating tokens through your black creatures dying, and also just the recursion you have in general, it doesn't take that much to be able to, you know, grind out those kind of decks and go into a late game to where you're in full control and you have the clear resource advantage over those kind of decks. And it helps that you're also in white, so you do have access to life gain when you need it, because musket decks or short-term all-in style decks tend to be red and like to deal lots of damage. So it helps that you're in white, and you're also in black as well, so you have access to some drain life effects if you need them too. Basically, Taysa is, we said it before, Taysa is good at playing the attrition game, and any kind of decks where they're going to struggle potentially at playing attrition-based games, Taysa is going to fare well against those kind of decks.
Okay, so we've been talking a lot about why she's good. Let's go over where you guys have run into trouble playing with her, or where you've given her trouble playing against her. I don't really know anything about her because I've literally never played against this deck before. So if I were to run up against one, like, what would be some strategies that I can do to kind of hamper her, aside from general things like, oh, blow up her lands, that hurts every deck. But what are some things where the Taysa deck might have some difficulty, might even fold up to specific archetypes, strategies, commanders, that kind of thing? Like Calvin mentioned, actually, she's good against the Voltron generals until they have hexproof. Like, is that kind of a major weakness that you can potentially have? Like, you're, sure, you're in the color of all these sweepers, like Carlos mentioned, but some of the really good Voltron generals have protection against that, like Thrun. Would somebody like Thrun give Taysa fits?
One of the kind of archetypes that I think would actually hurt Taysa the most is potentially herself.
Interesting.
Seeing as, one thing that, that her main issue is that in order to use her removal ability, you have to have 3 white creature tokens to sacrifice. Which means you have to have 4 creatures on the board, the 3 tokens plus Taysa. Now, if you happen to, say, use Wrath of God while Thrun is out on the board, do you really think that that's actually winning a race? Because you just had to waste a card, waste 4 of your own creatures, plus the card from your hand, just to get 1 Thrun. I mean, granted, she's in the color with the most board sweepers, but from my personal experience playing against her, she hates the fact that Wrath comes out until she's actually ready to get rid of all of her creatures anyway.
Carlos mentioned this before, but I definitely want to emphasize it, is that Taysa does have fair problems against counterspell-based decks because your threat density is low. You don't have exactly a whole lot of game-breaking spells because you're focused mainly on accumulating card advantage and board presence with your tokens over the course of the game. So cards like Taysa by herself, of 3 for 3 mana, she requires assistance from other cards to become really effective. Someone like a Bitter Blossom. Bitter Blossom's pretty good, but by itself, all it's doing is just spitting out 1/1s. And 1/1s tend to not get there when everyone has 40 life and people tend to drop bigger stuff out. So since you don't have like a whole lot of heavyweight style cards in your deck, it allows blue decks to kind of relax a bit more when it comes to like knowing what spells they can and can't counter. And it does kind of hurt in that sense. One thing, though, that does help for Taysa is that you are in probably one of the best color combinations possible for 2 colors. White-black is extremely powerful, and you have access to like a lot of card draw, a lot of tutors and things like that. But it also dilutes your game plan if you want to focus on Taysa. Like, if you're running like a white-black good stuff deck, then Taysa becomes more and more like a 2-3 for 3 mana, more than a 2-3 for 3 mana that has a lot of really powerful abilities tacked onto it.
To go off of that a little bit, in general, I find that decks like this are bad against instants and things that interact with them on their turn.
Like poor stack manipulation is kind of an issue here?
That is actually a very huge issue with decks like this, because the order in which you do things is very relevant, is very important, and the order in which you let things resolve and when you pass priority is important, because if you can run your combo with any of the Nim, Death, Mantle, or whatever combos that Taysa has, you can run through it without passing priority ever. But if you do an iteration and then pass priority, people can Path to Exile you, they can Crows and Grip you, they can Naturalize you. You open yourself up to all of this hate that blows you out. And so when you're all in on something like that, you can interact with creatures really easily because you have Wraths, you have Grave Pact, you have Attrition, you have Taysa's ability, you can make tokens. You're really good at interacting with creatures, but all of your really important cards are either artifacts or enchantments like Skullclamp, creatures like Sadistic Hypnotist. So if you're playing against decks that are also either playing attrition or playing control, you can have a lot of difficulty finding ways to force through a combo or force through the cards that actually interact with them in a meaningful way. So in general, the more creature-based a deck is, the better your matchup is against them. And the more spell or engine-based they are, the worse you are.
Okay, and my final thing that I'd like to discuss here on these general profiles is the effectiveness of the deck in the event that they lose access to their commander through something like a Tuck effect. Now, obviously, this is a universal rule for black. They have access to excellent tutors, so you have, I think, a better chance of finding the creature again in the event that you lose it to something like a Hinder or a Spell Crumple. But you guys have talked about a lot of Tace's excellence when she's being used as a combo piece or a game ender unto herself through engines she creates. So how adequate is this kind of deck once you lose access to that resource? Because like Carlos was talking about, your stack manipulation is not great, so it's kind of difficult to defend yourself against that.
Okay, so like I said before, it's going to depend upon how much you're investing in building around Tace and how much you're just building with good stuff cards. Because, again, black-white has some really crushingly powerful cards at its disposal. I mean, this is this color combination that has Vindicate, Mortify, Identity Crisis. That's probably one of those devastating spells in the format. Debtor's Knell is also pretty obvious. All right, so if you're running strategies that are independent of Tace, because of good stuff effects you run that are basically like secondary and tertiary strategies to Tace, then you're going to be relatively okay if Tace gets tucked, because you haven't committed to using her as your general and as your build arounding her for the entire deck. So you have like your secondary and tertiary strategies that can go around, so you can, you know, like tutor up artifacts with Stone Hero Giant, or you can just, you know, abuse Recursion in general with like Debtor's Knell, for example, or you can just like make people drop their hands with Identity Crisis, you know, Mind Twist, Miosion of Night's Reach, and things like that. If you're more committed to building around Tace, then this is just going to be something that is going to hose you pretty badly unless you draw into a black tutor that lets you get Tace back. But I think that pretty much goes without saying that's a problem for any deck that relies on their general heavily, if you tuck the general.
I'm actually going to disagree and say that Tace decks actually just don't care about tuck effects at all. A lot of the combo pieces that you have are cards that are just good on their own or that don't need Tace to combo, like Revelark and Karmic Guide and Nimdeath Mantle are all very powerful engines on their own. You also get access to stupid things like Twilight Shepherd and Necromancy, which is an insane interaction. The other thing that you need to keep in mind is that Tace can sacrifice herself to her white ability in response to removal. And so you can just, as long as you have enough creatures, you can just put her back in the command zone and not care about the tuck effects. So the thing that you're most afraid of is something like Hinder or Spell Crumple. And as long as you can deal with those, I don't think you generally care very much about tuck effects, because you can either play around them or, like Byron was saying, the power level of individual cards is so high that it just doesn't matter.
Well, one of the things I actually think would be interesting about Tace in this particular situation is that you have to remember that her main abilities require creatures. And in most decks that's going to be using her, those creatures are going to end up being tokens, because they're the easiest to dispense of, they're the easiest to get more of if needed. If a situation comes up and Tace gets tucked away, your deck still produces a ton of tokens, and now you just don't have a sac outlet for them, but you could potentially just turn the entire deck into just like a tokens deck, with different things like Cloud Gold Ranger just bringing in like the little 1/1 Kipkins. If Tace is not there, you still have the 3/3 plus the 2 plus the 3/1/1s anyway.
Alright, so that's it for our latest general profile. We were talking about Tace, the Orzhov Scion. If you have your own experiences, information, and or questions, as always, you can get a hold of us at CommanderCast.com. But we're going to round out our strategy segment for this week here, and next we're going to go into technology. We're going to be doing our Halloween theme deck.
Next up is going to be a new segment that's coming to you. I'm not sure if this is going to be a continuous thing, but...
You'll hear it again in the near future, I'm sure.
But it's called Captain's Order, and it's all based around theme decks. And if you know anything about me, you know I know a thing or two about themes.
But, it only seemed logical to have you on to kick off the new segment.
I feel so special. So this week, with the Captain's Order, we have a deck that was sent in by Robert, and it was a Halloween-based deck. Pretty much Robert sent in this deck to Commander Cast. It's a deck based around vampire hordes, and we figured, you know, why not try to expand on it and maybe, you know, try to work around with a Halloween-themed deck. But we're not really sure if we're actually going to be using it for vampires per se on this particular episode. So I'm going to hand it off to Andy, and let's see where this actually heads off to.
Yeah, the first thing I thought of was, you know, if we're going to go a little bit less towards effectiveness and a little bit more towards theme heavy. The first thing I thought was like Zola the Blood Witch, just because she's pretty sweet. And I don't see as many of those decks as I would like to. And immediately I was kind of thinking like a Thunderdome group slug style deck where you force everyone to attack one another. And it kind of represents the overall lurking evil of Halloween and all that shit. So I had a lot of cards in here like that were literally just theme picks. Like Fear. This is a card that's been reprinted a million times. It's a double black creature enchantment. And it gives the enchanted creature Fear. There's also Terror, which I'm sure does not really need an explanation. And then Cover of Darkness is another pick that I had in there. It's an enchantment that was printed in Onslaught. It was rare, and it's one colorless and one black. And when it comes into play, you choose a creature type. Creatures of the chosen type have fear. So if you're going to play that, it would probably be wise to go with a Halloween-themed tribe, like zombies and or vampires. But if you really want to go like theme heavy, then Cover of Darkness just unto itself certainly fits. And as well, there's the classic Bad Moon and Blood Moon. Bad Moon is one colorless and a black. It was reprinted many times as a rare enchantment, and it gives all black creatures +1/+1. Blood Moon, a perennial Andy favorite, is reprinted many times as well, but the best one that works the best, despite them all having empirically the same effect, is From the Dark. And it costs 2 colorless and a red, and it makes all the non-basics into mountains. So it's not really that hard for you to play around that in a bi-color deck anyway. You should be okay. But those are kind of the overarching Halloween-y cards that first jumped to my mind. So what do you guys kind of have going on here? I don't really have a cohesive strategy for this deck, but those were Halloween-ish cards.
The first thing I have is a real sense of disappointment that Uncle Istvan isn't a legend, because he would have been really awesome.
Just creeping on those kids trick-or-treating.
The second thing I did is I went through, like, my first thing was I wanted to look at awesome art, and so for that you go to the old sets where they used to do things that weren't quite as PC as they are now. And so if you go to Legends and look at cards with that start with H, you get a sequence of really awesome things, like Headless Horseman and Hellswarm and Hellfire and
Headless Horseman is
and
awesome.
Horror of Horrors. I didn't even know that was a card. Horror of Horrors? Like, the name is perfect.
It's the worst horror.
Black Carriage is another awesome one. Headstone is, like, 2 for an instant. You exile a card in a graveyard and draw a card on your next upkeep, which is kind of awesome.
Oh, that's a good... Yeah.
2 cards that are very good and on theme are Strands of Night and Dawn of the Dead. Those are both very good cards that don't see a ton of play, but are incredibly powerful and probably should be played a little bit more than they are.
All right. I'm not going to be able to contribute to this much because I'm not the go-to person when it comes to building theme decks like this, but one card that immediately came to mind was Cauldron Dance.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Out of Invasion, if you don't know what Cauldron Dance does, it's a 6-mana instant, 4 colorless, 1 black, 1 red. You can only cast it during combat. Allows you to return a creature from your graveyard to the battlefield. It gets haste, and then it gets returned back to your hand at the beginning of the next end step. And then you can also put a creature card from your hand directly on the battlefield that also gains haste, and then that card gets sacrificed at the beginning of the next end step. So basically you have 2 creatures swapping zones, essentially. I mean, it says Cauldron Dance. I mean, when you think of Halloween, you think of cauldrons and that kind of thing, and it fits right in the colors perfectly, and it's a nice
fucking sweet
level
card.
Yeah, I mean, like, and the nice thing is that it's at a nice power level. I mean, one of the things that can suck about theme decks sometimes is that you have to, like, run, like, awful cards, like, not just, like, bad cards, but, I mean, cards that are just so unspeakably bad sometimes. But, I mean, like, cards like Hellfire and Cauldron Dance and Blood Moon, things like that, those are perfectly acceptable to run cards. I wouldn't be embarrassed to run cards like that.
Well, continuing along that line, then, why don't we throw in Oversold Cemetery? This is a card that was printed in Onslaught. It's an enchantment. It was rare, and it costs 1 colorless and 1 black. At the beginning of your upkeep, if you have 4 more creatures in the graveyard, you can return one from your graveyard to your hand. And as well, you can put in Tortured Existence. Why not? It's a dungeon. It's creepy. It's probably a little more S&M than Halloween, but whatever. So what this card does is it's kind of like a junior Survival of the Fittest. It's a 1 black enchantment. It was printed in Stronghold. You pay 1 black and discard a creature card from your hand to return a creature card from your graveyard to your hand. So it's like a reverse survival. Interesting card, quite powerful in the right decks, and the way this deck is shaping up with all this kind of stuff we're throwing in here, I think it'd be a good choice anyway.
Well, if we're going along with themes as far as witches are concerned and things like that, we automatically have to add in a few extra witches. So I'm going to try to see what I can see about this. I think that two cards that have to automatically go in. First one is going to have to be the Bitter Heart Witch. It's four colorless and a black. It's a human shaman, has death touch. It's a 1/2. But when the Bitter Heart Witch dies, you may search your library for a curse card and put it on the battlefield, enchanting target player, then shuffle your library. And the enchantment that she should be searching up, another card from Innistrad, it's a black curse. It gives all creatures -1/-1, Curse of Death's Hold.
Curse of Death's Hold.
There you go. Thank you. And quite frankly, I think that these two cards work great together in a witch deck. Because, quite frankly, if you're going to kill a witch, you know for a fact that before she dies, she's going to tell you, oh, I'm going to haunt your family for the next few generations. And next thing you know, all your little 1/1s are just slowly falling off into the graveyard. And then Tessa's sitting there wondering how come they're not white. Another card that I think would actually be pretty good for a witch-based theme deck would have to be Season of the Witch.
Yes.
Now, this is a card from the dark. It's triple black, and it's an enchantment. At the beginning of your upkeep, sacrifice Season of the Witch unless you pay 2 life. At the beginning of the end step, destroy all untapped creatures that didn't attack this turn, except for creatures that couldn't attack. Pretty much, you're going to have this card out. You're going to be using your witches. You're going to be turning them sideways, which is something that I always promote. And if something comes up and creatures on your opponent's side of the field seem to be untapped, when he comes back around to the end, to their end turn, and they don't decide to attack, it's going to kill him. And also, I love the artwork on this because it's like a pair of like cloud skull eyes staring over like a forest.
Yeah, the art on that card is gorgeous. That's the kind of art that I really liked in Magic before. It was like a little more abstract, but yeah, that's a great card. I like that a lot.
I found a couple that are kind of neat, just kind of browsing through here. The Fallen and the Wretched are both. They have kind of awesome art, and they do some pretty interesting things. Cemetery Gate is kind of on theme. It's like it's a 0/5 pro black. It has some pretty sweet flavor text for this, though. It keeps some out. It also keeps others in.
Oh, you should have read it like Vincent Price. Come on.
I'm not good at this. What do you take me for?
I'm not a thespian.
The last card that seems kind of hilarious is Greed. If you get the old art where the guy's hoarding the coins.
Eating those money coins.
Oh, yeah,
coins.
I love that.
Didn't that used to be your old avatar, Andy?
Yeah, eating money coins. No, that was my jam.
Yeah, it was your old avatar.
That was my jam before I became Homer with the lopsided eye and the toast.
I'm hoarding all the candies.
Oh, yeah, he's just biting those monies. Well, he's got to see if they're chocolate coins. He's testing the coins. Yeah, I think that's a good pick right there. Another good one, actually, on theme with what Calum was talking about, is Witch's Mist. This is a very strange enchantment from Future Sight. It was uncommon. 2 colorless and a black, and you can pay 2 and tap to destroy target creature that was dealt damage this turn. So, a little bizarre. I don't think I've ever seen this card in real life, but hey, why not? I think it's on theme here. Mist, also Lethal Vapors. Sounds a little bit more terrorism-themed than Halloween-themed, but you know. We do our best here, Commander Cast, to get things popping like that. And you can also use Divining Witch, which is a very interesting card. Good? Maybe not. But funny? Definitely. Divining Witch was printed in Nemesis. It costs 1 colorless and a black. And it's a spell shaper, human. It's 1/1. You can pay 1 colorless and a black. And then you discard a card, name a card, exile the top 6 of your library. And you reveal cards this way until you reveal the named card and put that one in your hand and then exile all the other cards. So, why not? You know, you've ripped the top 6 off. Maybe they'll be good. Maybe not. It's super risky in a singleton deck because you might deck yourself. But like Donovan spoke of once on the show, you can use this card in response to somebody, say, trying to damage you somehow and say, oh, yeah, well, I'm just going to Divining Witch for something not in my deck. You're not getting this kill, bitch. And take yourself out of the game. I don't know if suicide is a theme of Halloween, but we just made it one.
Another creature I want to throw out, Axelrod Gunnarsson. That totally looks really Halloween-esque to me. I mean, I'm not the biggest flavor geek in the world, but that definitely sounds like something I wouldn't object to running. He's an 8-mana creature with trample. Whenever a creature dealt damage by Axelrod Gunnarsson this turn dies, you gain one life, and Axelrod deals one damage to target player. So it's a very overcosted beater, but it's still you're still getting something decent, I guess. But, I mean, it's another creature out there if you want to run it. I mean, I'm just going through Gather right now, just looking up random black red creatures and stuff.
Well, for the purposes of this deck, I think he might actually be an interesting general, because if we're going with a theme deck anyway, I don't think I've ever seen anyone running an Axelrod Gunnarsson deck. So yeah. why not? You know?
Though at that point, he's so prohibitively expensive as a general, he costs 8 mana. I mean, one of the nice things about a general like Lyzolda or Olivia Valdarin is that they're very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Another card I think would actually be pretty interesting to see would probably be Hell's Caretaker.
Do you know where you are, Bartholomew? You are about to enter hell.
Oh, yeah, good call.
It's 3 colorless and 1 black. It's a 1/1. It's a horror. It has tap, sacrifice a creature, return target creature card from your graveyard to your battlefield, activate this ability only during your upkeep. One of the things that I find interesting about this is that you could potentially just use it to tap and sack itself, because it doesn't say it has to be another creature. So it could be like pay 4, tap, sacrifice it. And if you happen to have something in your graveyard already, like say a Grave Titan or some other particular type of witch that you might want to search out, depending on any other curses that may potentially go into the deck, you could probably find another Bitterheart witch back. And, you know, easily just fill up your build with other creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And with black having other recursion cards in it, like, you could potentially bring it right back.
What about throwing a Thornbite staff in then so this thing can go infinite? And then you can just scratch out Thornbite and write Halloween under it, and it's totally on theme. I think we're onto something here.
Possibly.
I think it'll work.
Just scratch out words and write Halloween on there.
Yeah,
somewhere.
And then draw a pumpkin in the corner. So you will be solid as far as I'm concerned.
With the mentioning of pumpkin, I've got an idea. We could easily put in All Hallows Eve.
Oh, that yeah. Well, that makes sense.
I don't even understand why I completely forgot about that card we just talked about.
I think I actually had it in the show notes, but then we just didn't bring it up.
Kind of the reason why Halloween is named Halloween to begin with.
Makes a lot of sense, I think. You know what else would be good and on theme here? Tombstone Stairwell. And that's a card.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God.
And it just does not get enough love. But then you pair it up with, like, an Eldrazi monument and change it into a Halloween monument. And profit. But yeah, I think that would be a sweet card there. Like, we're kind of we're all over the place on this, but I think that's okay as a theme deck here. So we've had a whole bunch of cards thrown out there. Do you guys have any ideas on how to, like, kind of what would be the deck strategy that you would run here? Because I think that the cards that we're using naturally kind of lend themselves to a graveyard strategy here. And I honestly, I don't think it would be that hard to create a relatively good Lyzolla deck that's even on theme. Because Lyzolla is, like, Carlos, you did an article about her. I don't think the cards that we're throwing in here are that far off from a lot of the cards that were put in the article.
No, you could definitely make a very similar deck without too much trouble that's on theme, and it would be pretty reasonable. I mean, it's definitely not going to be, like, as good as something that you built to abuse Lyzolda, but it's definitely going to be a lot more fun to play, and I'm sure there'll be all kinds of hilarious Halloween jokes.
Oh, absolutely. Like your Halloween staff. Where did that come from, Andy? So we've got, like, lots of creatures, obviously. We've got all these witch creatures. We've got, like, the Hell's Caretakers and so on and so forth. Now, we've got all these recursion mechanisms as well. Is this going to be kind of like a... Because I was thinking about that Thunderdome-style deck earlier where you're forcing everyone to attack and block, and you've got cards like Grand Melee, and you can use that curse that makes people attack every turn as well.
A curse of the Nightly Hunt.
Yeah, you can use Curse the Nightly Hunt, and I think that would be good there, and then you can throw in Grand Melee and say that that's all the kids running out to trick-or-treat. And I think you have a reasonable theme there as well with the forced attacks and everything, making everybody be proactive.
You could even run a card like Anthem of Rakdos.
Yes! That's just a card that people should use more anyway, because it's totally sweet.
It's like it's like another Furnace of Wrath.
Who ever gets tired of Furnace of Wrath? I love those games that just spiral down into the gutter so fast once one is played. It's the greatest.
Let's just throw Malfagor in here to get us hellbent.
Yeah, Malfagor, out of nowhere, where doesn't he fit?
He's a demon. He's on theme.
Yeah, he's a rock star, too, so I mean, what are you thinking?
yeah, since we're talking about Malfagor and demon dragons, I also want to talk about, like, a vampire dragon and vampiric dragon. I've always loved vampiric dragon ever since I started playing in Odyssey. He was, like, one of my favorite big creatures ever.
Yeah, he seems acutely on theme here. So there you go. I think we've got a theme deck. It's probably going to take a while for everyone to sort through all the suggestions that we threw out there and maybe try to compose a workable deck out of it. But I'm sure there's something there that will interest people. And as well, as always, if you have suggestions, comments, or concerns, if those are a thing you can have over a theme deck, send them in to maybe my terrorism remarks or something. I don't know. Contact information is always in the show notes. But yeah, that's it for our first go at Captain's Orders. So if you guys have suggestions for themes that you would like us to explore, as I've said in the past, these segments always take a while to kind of iron out and get into the top form that some of our long-running segments are. So if you have suggestions on how we could do this, kind of a breakdown in terms of how you would like to see them played out, that would be great. Send them in to us. And we're going to take it straight to the outro right now because Byron's breaking up on us here. We got to do something. That rounds out Commander Cast Season 4, Episode 7. I want to thank you guys, as always, for coming out and helping me out on this episode. This was our really weak Halloween theme episode, so yeah, there we go. Clinched right there. Now, if you have any thoughts, anything you'd like to say to us, as always, CommanderCast.com is the place to go. You can also find us on MTGCast.com and QuietSpeculation.com. If any of us you'd like to get a hold of personally, you can get a hold of me. I'm Andy, a.k.a. Ghosts, all over the internet. CommanderCast@gmail.com, at CommanderCast on Twitter. All comments left on CommanderCast.com I do see, moderate, and usually respond to. So if you have anything to say to me, don't be shy to get a hold of me. I love it when you guys send me the feedback and the emails. And then for you guys, how would people get a hold of you? We'll start with Calvin, because he's the guest.
Well, if anybody wants to get in contact with me, CaptainRedZone@gmail.com. You can also stop by my blog spot, greetoface.blogspot.com. Respond to emails and comments pretty quickly. I'm also on Twitter, but I wouldn't suggest using that as a way to particularly contact me because I look at it like maybe like, what, once a week?
Mm-hmm.
If you actually want to get in contact with me, the place I'm usually at is the Facebook group that I have for 3 to Face.
Okay, right on. We'll have a link in the show notes to all that stuff. So then, Byron, if people want to get a hold of you, how would they do that?
All right, so you can get a hold of my email, surgingchaos19@gmail.com. I check that every day. I'm also on Twitter. twitter.com/surgingchaos, all one word, lowercase. I'm also a forum monster, and I visit MTG Salvation and the official commander site on a daily basis as well, so you can get a hold of me there as well, and that's basically how you can contact me.
All right, and then finally, Carlos.
All right, if you want to get in touch with me, you can get me at CAG5383, either at Gmail or on Twitter. You can check out my articles and leave comments there on Quiet Speculation every Tuesday. And that should be pretty good.
Okay, so then just a quick reminder for next week, that is the onset of Crossover Month, and you will see one of Calvin's articles as well, a pretty good one, actually, and he's talking about the Ib Nation. So Ib Nation, stand up, as always. If you want to see Calvin's take on that deck, be sure to check back. I think it'll be the week after this one, where he'll be doing his crossover, and the first episode of Crossover Week as well, our guests will be Gavin Duggan, a.k.a. Genomancer from the EDH Rules Committee. And our podcast guest for that week is Sean Patchen, a.k.a. Swords of Plow. He writes on CommanderCast, but now he's also appearing on CommanderCast, guesting from Redcast Wins. And Byron will be crossing over to Redcast Wins to do a podcast with them, so I'm sure keep your eyes open for that. But that's it for this week on CommanderCast. Be sure to check in next week for more community strategy and technology as we begin our crossover month. Spooky and shit!